Welcome to the History of Networking, where we drag all of the skeletons out of the wiring closet and ponder the ghosts of protocols past.
Well, hello, Donald.
Morning.
How are you today?
Good.
Tie-dyed shirt and turtle.
Exactly.
Yep. Awesome. And today we have with us Heather Flanagan to talk to us about, well, we don't really, I mean, it's history of identity, but we're going to have to identify what that is. I don't know. So hi, Heather, where are you physically? You are, I think, in the valley someplace.
I am on a small island outside of Seattle.
Oh, wow. Well, that's really nice.
Yes. Yeah, so you guys get to wear t-shirts and I'm wearing a sweatshirt, sweatpants, wool socks. It's summer.
So Heather, talk to us about identity, unless you want to start with where you got in networking, but talk to us about identity a little bit and talk to us about how we got to where we are today.
Well, did you guys know that I'm a history major? Yes. Yes, I'm actually a history major. So to say, you know, like where do things start is almost impossible. Because everything is based on something that came before it for some, you know, reason. And for me, when I look at this stuff, I really look at the people that were involved and how their personalities and just how human nature has driven technology and adoption. And at the heart of that, you know, if we're coming to identity and where did it start for, say, the internet, it started with the concept of everybody knew everybody. Trust was as local as trust could be. You didn't need to worry about authenticating a stranger, because there weren't any strangers. And the technology just built on top of that, where the assumption was always that trust was going to happen at that local layer. That, of course, UC Berkeley knew who was using their physical computers because that was their job. And then everybody, again, knew everybody else.
Like Paul Vixie talking about actually carrying the DNS root zone file around on a disk and copying it into all the right machines.
Or like someone, you know, calling John Postel and saying, hey, can you add me to a host file? It was very much a who do you know? And, you know, I came through to the identity space through academia. It's been very much a, you know, what are all our local accounts? How do we create local accounts? But then how do we federate those local accounts so that people outside of our specific institution can use them? That's, you know, that need is kind of where SAML came from back in the day. That whole markup language of we need to be able to share information about people because we have this local trust. We know who they are. But that university over there does not have the infrastructure to know anything about these users, and yet the users need to access their material. How do they do it? It was very much a people-driven thing of who gets to know the information about the individual and how do you share that appropriately.
And how, I mean, when you start in the academic environment, of course, there's a lot more trust just because people know one another, like you said, right? It's just all the professors know each other. You go to any college and everybody knows who everybody is. Even if they don't know them personally, they know who they are because they've read their published work and stuff. Was a lot of that just because of the movement into the commercial realm, or was that even before the commercial thing started coming out of it?
Well, it's been about 20 years now, so I would say it was pretty much at the start of how do you use the commercial infrastructure? Cloud was really starting to become a thing. It wasn't really a thing, but it was starting to become a thing. How do you share someone else's computer? And more decisions were being made on not so much, I need to know that Russ White is using this. It was, I need to know that a faculty member is using this. How do you do that?
Rather than someone climbing through a window.
Yeah. Now, as things have evolved over time, it's gotten that much more complicated. It was so easy in a way. It was so easy when everybody had to sit down at a physical computer that was plugged into the wall. Because then you, again, had that level of comfort of, okay, you know that they're like physically present on the campus. So even if they're a walk-in user to the library, you know that, you know, they're a library patron at that library. And that's all you need to know. As web cafes happen, as work from home happened, as, you know, remote campuses happen, that's really become less and less of a thing. And academic institutions are still struggling with that, actually. My ongoing dismay, the library part of universities still heavily rely on IP addresses for authorization purposes.
Which, it's like watching one of those police shows where they say, I've tracked his IP address to Miami. Yeah, right.
I know, you just want to sit there and go, no, that's not how you do it. And we're working on that, but they feel like they can get a hold of the IP address. They know their IP address. They trust their IP address. It's their local thing. When you take it to the federated identity space, where suddenly, you know, it's your identity provider at your institution that controls what comes in and what goes out. The librarians aren't part of that. You were saying, you know, well, okay, everybody on campus knows everybody else. Well, not exactly. Not so much. There's politics, go figure.
There's politics. Yes, well, I think a lot of the problem with identity and with the security in the internet in general is that we latched onto the IP address as a machine identifier, almost as a person identifier from day one. Mm-hmm. It was never designed to be. It was designed to be a topological location. Yeah. It's like saying you live in, you know, Seattle. Well, yeah, that's great, but that doesn't mean anything because you might be in San Jose, or you might be in San Francisco. So mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter where you live as to who you are. So it doesn't really matter where you connect to the network as to who you are. We just seem to somehow mentally equate those two and make it, that seems to me to be a lot of the problem that we run into.
But that's how people work. That's how people think. You know, people are not very good at that kind of abstraction of, okay, IP address doesn't mean physical where you are. It means something in a way more ephemeral than that. It's just an identifier. Oh no, man, that doesn't work because I need that connection for it to be a thing. I need to know that this phone number, right? Phone number, it's actually an abstract thing. It's not assigned to a person. Well, then why did it become such a huge, huge issue that phone numbers become portable? Right? Remember when that was like a big debate? We have to have these to be portable because they've become associated with a person. And the person.
And we ended up with EIDs that actually indicate the device, mm-hmm. and then a phone number that's mapped to the EID using a mapping database, much like DNS in many ways. It's solving the same problem as DNS is. And yeah, I mean, we don't. Yes, it actually is very similar. ATM lane.
Sounds like Lisp.
Yeah. We keep reinventing these technologies over and over again because we find it so difficult, probably because it's so difficult to take into account how the users actually think and how they use that and their need for an identity.
Yeah. So going back to SAML, talk to us about SAML and how that came about, and then maybe move forward in the history with how federated identity started and stuff like that, so that we can get a sense of how it progressed. What happened?
You know, when I looked at that, I'm like, okay, how did SAML start? Well, Scott Cantor, who's a guy I work with, he's at the Ohio State University. He was like the primary author of writing that specification to help figure out how do you create the metadata in that markup language to capture attribute information and release it across the network. It's been a very, very stable, specification for many years. And you will hear, if you can go to your favorite browser engine and type SAML is dead, because people have been saying SAML is dead for a really long time. Everybody uses it, right? I was talking to Ian Glazer at Salesforce, and he pointed out that Salesforce has 70,000 bilateral federation things set up for their customers using SAML, but SAML is dead. It's dead because it's stable. It does what it needs to do. It doesn't do anything else. I think it's a version 2.
Okay. So how did that, I mean, what was the driver was just the ability to do federated identity when SAML came out? I mean, that was the entire point? Or was it, how did it come about that people started working on this?
My impression is that the federated identity was the driver. And that might be some retrospective history on my part, because I wasn't involved in the spec writing. But based on the people I know, that's what they needed it to do. I don't know that it has ever been used for anything else. Might have been. but if it is, I'm not aware of it.
What's a federated identity?
Oh, well, that's a wonderful question. So glad that you asked. A federated identity is an identity hosted at a home organization or institution, which is shareable in bite-sized components, attribute-sized components, out to other institutions or service providers or what have you. But the core of it is the fact that it's hosted in one place, and then that one place can interact with completely, you know, third party, either services or resources or what have you, that come back and say, we need, can you authenticate this person for us? And it goes back to the home institution to do it.
So basically it's a pointer. It's like a URI for a person or an entity of some type. You point you back to a place where you can find out about that person, like a certificate or something like that, a CA or something that lets you find out about that person.
There are entity IDs, which are URIs, and then the discovery will take you to that entity ID, and the person can do the authentication, and information then flows back in the form of various attributes and other bits and pieces of info, usually based on a SAML spec. SAML isn't the only thing that does this. You also have OAuth.
OAuth. Okay. So why did OAuth come about if SAML was there?
Because SAML was really, really good at that interaction. You have a person, they're doing a thing. They are authenticating back. Think now take a step forward and think about your mobile apps, which are authenticating behind the scenes, maybe staying authenticated or renewing their session or whatnot. Suddenly you've got a situation where it's not the person ready to type, ready to share information back and forth. It's happening actually at the application layer, not at the person layer. And SAML was never designed for that application layer bit. And that's where OAuth has come in. One thing I don't know, and it's a source of irritation to me, is why did they choose to create OAuth rather than adapt SAML?
Adapt SAML. That's actually a good question, because I would be curious to ask the people who did OAuth.
I have always been curious about that, but if you think about it, that's what we do. You know, that's your little S-curve adoption cycle, right? People will create a thing and adapt a thing, and then it becomes stable. And then for whatever reason, they'll reinvent it. They'll say, okay, well, that simply doesn't meet my need anymore. And I don't want to deal with the history behind why this all came about. You know what? I'm just going to start from scratch. That was too complicated. I'm making it simple. Damn it. I'm going to start here.
Yes. Well, funny enough, we seem to be doing that with tunneling protocols since the beginning of the ITF, since the beginning of GRE.
We do it all the time. So when I first started being in IT, I actually, well, my first baby was DNS, but my second baby was SendMail, right? And SendMail, you know, became more and more complicated because people say it kept adding use cases. Well, I also needed to do this. I needed to do that. I needed to do the other. Until you had this enormous, complicated beast of a thing to run for your email system, at which point someone said, okay, this is just absurd. I just want this one simple thing. And so they create PostFix. And then it's like, okay, well, it does everything, but could you add this one more thing? And this thing. And this, until it becomes this massive monolithic beast. And you just reinvent this over and over and over again. We do it with every technology I have ever heard of.
Well, it's funny because I'm watching it happening in container land right now. I'm watching it happen with routing. And, oh, we're going to start out with something very, very simple. Routing is too complex. And then they keep adding to it and adding to it. And they're actually more complex than just running BGP or something else at this point. It's like, what?
Sure. But it's not sexy to work on an old technology. It just isn't. It's kind of boring. If you look in the identity space, so one of the organizations I work with is called ID Pro. It's a professional organization for identity and access management specialists. And they do this annual survey. And one of the questions that they ask is, how long did it take you to feel proficient in identity and access management? How long did it take? And it worked out to be, years, years and years and years. So when you get the new people coming in, they look at this curve and say, oh my God, that's insane. Is there, you know, something simpler? Is there something that I can actually be a part of to build as opposed to trying to climb that enormous hill? And I think that's part of why now there's like all this, you know, it's going to be a little early to start the blockchain drinking game, but let's go there. You know, why is blockchain this big identity thing? Well, it's newer. It's sexy. It's actually where a lot of the new kids are going to try and figure out, I just can't work with this old stuff anymore. It's too hard to change. So I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it again in my way. Won't that be fun?
And it'll be too hard to change in 5 years. And somebody will do it all over again. That's exactly right. So Saml OAuth came after Saml. Is that correct? I mean, so OAuth is how many years after Saml? Was there anything in the middle? Or is that pretty much the progression?
For that level of stuff where you're talking about attribute sharing, there was a lot of that. I mean, LDAP comes in there as well as sort of a source that feeds all of this. And LDAP has been around for far longer than both SAML and OAuth. But when you get to that organization level of, well, where is your data stored? And what does it look like? And how is it structured? LDAP was a really, you know, foundational and remains a foundational part of how we store identity data, I think.
So LDAP is like a database that OAuth and SAML are relying on to grab that identity information, like the URI or whatever it is, to get to send to people. Is that correct? Is that a right way of putting it?
You could look at it that way. You could look at it that way. It takes out a bunch of layers in there. I mean, LDAP is a directory. What format does that directory take? You could have it backed by a relational database.
Oh, okay.
Or not.
So LDAP is middleware.
It's middleware. So it's middleware that comes before the other middleware.
Okay. All right. So it's middleware under the middleware. All right. So we have LDAP that existed before. I mean, where did LDAP come from? I mean, if it's older than OAuth, and if it's older than, where did that come from? Why were people starting with LDAP?
Where did LDAP come from? I don't know, but you know, if you go to the RFC editor website,
RFC 4511, that's version 3.
LDAP really started July 1993, RFC 1487.
So it's just interesting, too, that the URIs are in there. I didn't think that URIs were that old, but I guess they were. I mean, maybe that's why URIs came about, because we went from URLs to URIs at some point. And maybe that's one of the reasons we went between the two, because originally they were just URLs, right? And then there were URIs. That's kind of one of those things that I've never really understood. But so taking us forward, there's LDAP, there's OAuth. And so historically, was there anything after OAuth? What is more current, or what has happened after OAuth? Or is there anything after OAuth at this point?
That's still an ongoing thing. I mean, there's a layer that I can't explain that is built on top of OAuth called OpenID Connect, which isn't a protocol. It's I live in SAML land, just to be perfectly clear. With most of the work I do in identity, I'm very much a SAML person. And anytime I have to deal with OpenID Connect, which is built on top of OAuth, I reach out to one of my friends and say, can you do the thing with the stuff? And then they make magic happen. There are several proxies that will actually proxy between SAML and OAuth, because sometimes you're going to end up with an institution, most higher ed institutions, for example, which absolutely live in, again, in the SAML space. That's how they express their data about individuals. But service providers have found that the libraries for OpenID Connect, built on top of OAuth, are much, much easier to implement. So how do you get there from here? You put a protocol proxy in between that will actually translate one to the other. And there have been efforts to do actual attribute mapping, because there are some very common attributes in the SAML space, especially, again, back to higher education, that needed to have some kind of, you know, okay, well, what does that mean in an OpenID Connect world?
It looks like OAuth began for Twitter OpenID, for people to be able to share their authentication without sharing their actual passwords between sites. So this is how most third party, like if you go to a website and it says sign in with, yes.
You said Twitter.
Yes.
Did you mean Twitter?
Yeah, Twitter.
Twitter.
Yes.
Interesting. So, was that? But wasn't Twitter kind of like after Facebook?
It's 2006 is when it was originally developed. When OAuth was originally developed.
Regardless of whether it was Twitter or Facebook or something else entirely, that the whole point was that it was able to do the application layer that SAML wasn't up for.
Right. So SAML was designed more for terminal side, for more organizational. Is that what you're saying? And then OAuth was designed more for this. If you go to a website and it says log in with Google, that's OAuth. And SAML can't support that.
Yes, it can. If you go to a website and it says log in, then you can do local accounts, you can do SAML federated accounts, you can do OAuth accounts, you can do all of those things. If you go to your phone and there's authentication happening behind, within the application itself, then you're talking something that's OAuth based or some kind of weird local account, but for argument's sake, we'll say OAuth based.
So I'd be very curious how OAuth came out of SAML or why if they're so close in what they do, other than have OAuth having more, why that came to be rather than using SAML.
The other thing you'll find that's a common differentiator, and I don't think it has to be, it's just how things have worked out. There are thousands upon thousands of SAML based identity providers around the world. So when you go to a service provider and you want to log in using, your home institution's account, you have to find your identity provider in a list. That's called an identity provider discovery problem. And one of the other projects I work on, because, I'm a freelancer, and if there's a group that's collaborating in identity and is largely volunteers, I want to be a part of it. That's what they're trying to solve, because the user experience for how do you find your institution in a list of thousands is a complicated user experience issue. But if you're just doing a social identity, I think the largest list I've seen is six. You have six to choose from. Google, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Yeah, it's a very, very small list.
It's not very big. Yeah, it's not very many that provide those kinds of services. Well, it's not that many people who actually do the kind of verification or validation that those companies do, because that's the business they're kind of part of the business they're in, to say.
One of the things that people have to think about when they're thinking about all this identity stuff, and it's something that has evolved with the identity space on the network, is how much do you actually need to know who the person is as opposed to what the person is?
Let's talk about that for a little bit. So has there been like a running discussion in the identity space about that? And has it gone back and forth? Have people said it should be this way or that way? Or what kind of arguments have been used in both directions?
For that kind of stuff, I would actually point you to NIST.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Doug and those guys.
The National Information Standards and Technology, something, NIST. NIST. Everybody knows NIST. NIST 863 is their guidelines on handling identity. And they are just starting their fourth round of that. And it's gotten more complicated in each round. But it does focus on things like, well, how do you have any level of assurance as to whether this is the same Jane Smith, is this the Jane Smith, or is it just the same person who happens to be labeled as Jane Smith as it was the last time? It has over time offered some guidance on what do you need to do in order to get to the assurance level that you need, but have for a site to actually decide what assurance level they need has been complicated. Sometimes there's guidance along those lines based on regulation. So in the US, for example, HIPAA, that's dealing with patient privacy, that's, they need to know more detailed information about a person and whether that person is who that person says they are. And more to the point, whether the person accessing their records are the people that are who they say they are. But in other places and other situations, it's more of it doesn't actually matter. As long as they're a student, it's all we care about.
So, I mean, there must be a history there. There must be incidents that have Catch Me If You Can and things like that, if you remember that book, that have convinced people that it's more important or less important to prove identity or functional role over time.
Well, but it's such a contextual thing. So there's certainly scare moments, you know, that you can point to throughout history where it's like, oh my gosh, of course we need to know because look at this bad thing that happened. But that's not how reality actually works. Getting to a high level of assurance that I'm talking to the Russ White, that was the name you were born with, that, you know, this is your social security number, that you are that person when I can't actually physically get my hands on you and do fingerprints and whatnot. That's really expensive. So you have to think about that.
So Russ, who was your best man? Let us know. What street did you grow up on, Russ, when you were 10?
I don't know. Yeah, I think those are pretty useless myself. So yeah, talk to us about that a little bit. I mean, what's the history of those things? Why do people think that those are useful? I mean, where did that come from? Like,
well, because sometimes they are. Sometimes they're very useful. I'm going to tell you a story. It's a very silly story, but I was in a conversation with one of the scientists at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory Project, LIGO. LIGO was in the news last year, earlier this year. They discovered their gravitational waves. It was a really big deal. I've been working with them probably for 10 years now, talking to them either officially or unofficially about the situations they have with needing to validate identities. Now, LIGO has 1,000 scientists that participate from institutions around the world. And the last thing that they really want to be spending their money on is identity and access management, right? They really want to just be able to have the home institutions for these scientists. You manage this guy's life cycle. You figure out if they're actually still a part of your institution or not, because how am I supposed to know? I'm working on science, damn it. So when I was talking to this scientist about this, it's like, okay, well, they were very, very anxious that for access to, say, a wiki, yeah, you know, it wasn't that big a deal. But heavens forfend the day that a random user was able to actually get to the raw data or to the equipment itself and access it remotely. Here's what he said about it. He said, here's my worry. Imagine, if you will, some punk grad student manages to break into the system. And he, you know, he logs in however he's done it. And he inserts data into the data set. And then he waits a couple weeks, maybe a couple months. And then, oh, look, he discovers gravitational waves. He's named on the paper. He wins the Nobel Prize for having discovered gravitational waves. A couple years pass. He's drinking at a bar. And he's like, you remember that time? You remember that time? I did that. That was me. Right? Oh, and this makes the news. And it all blows up. The granting agencies that actually funded the institution to do this, they start pulling their funding. The Nobel Prize Committee demands their prize back. And it comes down to the question of, who was managing the identity system that let this bozo get involved? Because you know what? They're going to ask me, and I'm going to go to jail, and there's going to be some guy named Bubba who thinks I'm pretty, and I'm just not okay with this. And I was like, whoa. You know, I was right with you until Bubba, dude. But all right, I hear your concern. There comes a point where it's really freaking important that you know who's on your system, that you have the assurance that they are who they say they are, and they're the same person every time.
So you would say it's not so much scare moments, again, like Catch Me If You Can, or who was the guy who caught the, I can't remember the name of the book, but he caught the hacker by taking his car keys or his house keys and rattling it over the telephone line to induce enough. There's a story about this where he induced enough noise onto the modem line to make the guy stay on so they could trace the call and figure out where he was, because he was trying to download a file across a modem. And so he was like inducing crosstalk, nearing crosstalk in the physical phone wire by rattling his keys over it. So it would induce enough errors, CRC errors, to make the guy take longer to download the file to keep the circuit open to trace him. Yeah, it was pretty funny. But I mean, so it wasn't incidents like this, you're saying. It's just these realization moments of these institutions that oh yeah, identity does matter, and we need to go figure out how to fix this. For those
that identity sometimes matters.
Right?
Because when as soon as they got to, you know, it's very often that they would start of it always matters, and then they would look at the price tag and say, maybe we're being a little extreme. Maybe we should back off on that. Where does it really matter? Because what can we afford to do?
So there's basically just been SAML and OAuth, and now there's new Bitcoin stuff. I always say that when I mean blockchain. Bitcoin sticks in your head.
The blockchain stuff. So here's the block. Well, that's because why was blockchain invented?
Was for Bitcoin, basically.
Was for Bitcoin. Now, it being able to do that, it suddenly was like, well, wait, if it could do that, what else could it do? It became interesting and new and potentially really sexy. And if it can do something that involves money, maybe I can make some money. Oh, how can I use this to make money? You know, it's if you'd had that conversation with, okay, how can I use SAML to make money? People, you know, once they got up off the floor from laughing themselves sick, right? It's not a conversation that you ever have. But you start talking about blockchain, there are very, very few people in the identity space that are new to the space. And if you want to talk to the folks that are really energized and excited and on the fast end of development, you've got to get out of the SAML OAuth space and go talk to the blockchain people who, anyone in the SAML, you know, OAuth space are like, oh, please. You know, there's no respect. The blockchain is, it's a solution in search of a problem. It's got some serious, you know, things that people consider fatal flaws embedded in it. Even NIST wrote up a paper that said, all right, here's the 10 things that have to align for this technology to be of value to you. Otherwise, use a relational database. Do something else. This doesn't make sense. Does what it needs to do. You do have to have a reasonable understanding of the complexities of identity as a construct, of how it changes in context, of the fact that there are attribute schema out there that you need to be able to work with. You get to all of this, and then suddenly there's also the questions of, okay, now you know you have a protocol to share attribute information. Great, actually, you've got a couple, but we'll work with SAML for now. You've got one that will share attribute information. You've got a directory and you know how to populate that with information. Cool. Then what do you need to know next? Next, you need to actually have judgment. You need to know when you can do this. You know, what are the implications of releasing this data? Who is liable for this data if something goes wrong, if information is hacked? Or if, you know, someone accesses something they shouldn't, you know, what do you have privacy legislation that means someone will go to jail? You've got protected student information in the U.S. There's a law called FERPA. You know, what are you actually allowed to share, and who gets in trouble if you screw it up? That judgment, you know, the T-shirt, the seven-layer OSI model that also has financial and political. Yeah, that's a really big pair of layers right there, and they impact the identity space in very, very significant ways.
So where's the government? Because I'm sorry, I asked the question poorly. Where would, you know, it seems natural to me that government would be interested in providing proof of identity, not just in a passport form, but in a digital form as well. And I was wondering where that is, or what efforts are going on there?
Oh, there's a lot going on in that space. But there's a few things to keep in mind. As soon as you open up that conversation, you open up a conversation about culture. Because when someone from the United States says, well, why doesn't the government issue this material? because we've already got passports, we've already got this, and we know how, we nominally know that we can control our government in some same way, shapes, or form. We have voting, we, you know, we can hold government accountable if they misuse our data. Well, that's nice, but that's not how a lot of countries work. You're going to have something that could work for the, we'll say North America. We'll include Mexico and Canada in this, sure. But will it work for most of Africa? What about most of Asia? And you've got business partners over there. You've got educational partners over there. Each country is now going to have different legislation and regulation guidance in terms of exactly how you handle all of this data and who's allowed to receive it. I recently helped someone write a white paper on just how broken the concept of consent for identity is, because the governments are trying to put together this legislation that says, okay, someone has to consent to releasing their information. Okay, what counts as having complied to this regulation? Is having a 43-page user level agreement that indicates somewhere in the bottom two thirds of how it's going to be done, and someone has to accept that, does that count? Or maybe a cookie. Ooh, I know those glorious cookie bars that just say, we're gonna add a cookie. Are you okay with that? There's no good guidance. And yet everyone says it's really, really important to do. So I would say there's a lot of activity in the space, but it's acting more like churn and not like a highway with a direction. I want to direct y'all to one more thing, just because I think it was a fun thing to read. So Pam Dingle, she currently works at Microsoft. She wrote an article called The Introduction to Identity, Part 2, Access Management. That's in the ID Pro's growing body of knowledge. If you just search ID Pro body of knowledge, you'll get a link. That gives you actually quite a bit of history, particularly around access, and it's just a fun thing to read. It's not very long. It's about somewhere between 7 and 10 pages, I think. But if anyone wants to just read a little bit more about this in a fun way, that's a place I'd point you.
Well, Heather, where can people get in touch with you if they want to? Like, do you have a blog where you keep up with things? You said you're independent, so you must have a website.
Of course I do. any number of ways. So you can, you know, I occasionally post to a blog on my website, SphericalCowConsulting.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn. I post a lot there as well. And on Twitter, I'm SPHCow.
We're not going to ask where that came from.
It's because of the physicists. That's why. Because when I first went independent, the first groups I started talking to were the physicists, and spherical cows are a very, very old joke that have at their heart theoretical physicists who take really complicated things and squish them down into something simple enough to actually work on, which is what I do for a living.
All right. And Donald, you're me, not you, sharp, right?
On Twitter, yes.
On Twitter. Anything else other than Git? Nothing but Git. All right. I'm Russ White. You can find me at rule11.tech or on Twitter at routinggeek, although I never log into Twitter. So don't bother PMing me, because I don't answer PMs on Twitter. Just email me if you want to get in touch. It's just a lot easier. And this is the History of Networking. Thanks for joining us for this episode.
Subscribe to the History of Networking on your favorite podcast service, or follow along at rule11.tech.